By the end of half an hour, we were looking fairly respectable. The scabs on my face were healing. I tried to grin, but they hurt too much. No Prozac, but we'd pass muster. I picked up the bag. You ready?
We're going to England now.
Just one thing left to do. Follow me. I pulled at her stubby ponytail that made her look like a 4-foot-tall cheerleader. She pretended to be annoyed, but I could tell she liked the attention. We went back up the escalator and walked around the edge of the terminal, seemingly looking at the aircraft out on the tarmac. In fact, there were two quite different things I was looking for. I need to post something, I said, spotting the FedEx box. I used the credit card details on the Harkire agreement to fill in the dispatch form. Fuck it, Big Al could pay for a few things now he was rich. Kelly was watching my every movement.
Who are you writing to?
I'm sending something to England, in case we are stopped. I showed her the floppy disk and backup disk.
Who are you sending it to?
She got more like her dad every day. Don't be so nosy. I put them in the envelope, sealed it, and entered the delivery details. In the past, we'd used the FedEx system to send the firm photos that we'd taken of a target and developed in a hotel room, or other highly sensitive material. It saved getting caught in possession. Nowadays, however, the system was obsolete. With digital cameras, you can take pictures, plug in your GSM mobile, dial up the UK and transmit. We continued walking around the edge of the terminal. I found the PowerPoint I was looking for at the end of a row of black plastic seats where two students were snoring. I pointed to the last two spaces. Let's sit down here. I want to look at the laptop. I got it plugged in, and Kelly decided she wanted something to eat. Give me 5 minutes, I said. From what I'd seen already, I understood Gibraltar was a setup. But it still didn't explain what Kev had to do with it. As I read on, it became clear. It seemed that in the late 1980s, the Bush administration had been under pressure from Thatcher to do something about NORAD's fundraising for PIRA. With so many millions of American-Irish votes on the line, however, it was a tricky call. A deal was struck. If the Brits could expose the fact that NORAD money was being used to buy drugs, it would help discredit PIRA in the USA, and Bush could then take action. After all, who would complain about a US administration fighting the spread of dangerous narcotics? When the British Intelligence Service started to gather int about PIRA's drug connections with Gibraltar, it seemed to present a window of opportunity. After the events of the 6th of March, however, the window was slammed shut. Those votes were too important. By the early 1990s, the US had a new administration, and the UK a new Prime Minister. In Northern Ireland, the peace process began. The US were told, and the message was delivered at the highest level, that unless they put pressure on PIRA to come to the peace table, the UK would expose what was happening to NORAD funds raised in America. It would look to the world like a failure by a power that preached so readily to others to fight the drug war in its own backyard. Another deal was struck. Clinton allowed Gerry Adams into the USA in 1995. A move that was not only good for the Irish-American vote, but made Clinton look like the Prince of Peacemakers. He also appeared to be snubbing John Major's stand against PIRA, but the British didn't mind. They knew the agenda. Behind closed doors, Gerry Adams was told that if PIRA didn't let the peace process happen, the US would come down on them like a ton of steaming shit. A ceasefire was indeed declared. It seemed that it was now time to talk for real instead of the years of covert talks that had gone nowhere. Clinton and the British government would be seen as peace brokers, and PIRA would have a say in the way the deal was shaped. On the 12th of February 1996, however, a massive bomb exploded at Canary Wharf in London, killing two and causing hundreds of millions of pounds worth of damage. The ceasefire was broken. It was back to business as usual. But it didn't end there. Kev had also discovered that Pyra had been trying to blackmail certain Gibraltarian officials with some success. It seemed Gibraltar was still the key to Europe. Spain was far too much of a risk. They had also targeted some important personalities in the US, so they could continue to operate their drugs business with impunity. One of the victims was high up in the DEA. Kev's problem was he didn't know who. I did. I had the photograph of his boss. And now I knew why McGeer, Fernahan, and McCauley had been in Gibraltar. Whoever the official was, they'd been there to give him a gypsy's warning, and to try to blackmail him with the shipment documents and photographs to get the route open again. Maybe Etta had wanted too big a cut of the profits in Spain. I closed down the laptop. I had to get back to the UK. I had to see Simmons. Kelly had been watching me.
Good, she said. Can we have breakfast now?
I walked with her to Dunkin' Donuts. She had a carton of milk. I had coffee and we both got stuck into some big, stinking donuts. I had six. At 10 o'clock, we went back down the escalator to international arrivals. I needed passports. British or American, I didn't care. I scanned the international flights on the monitor. Chances were we were going to end up with American documents as opposed to British, purely because of the number of families streaming back from the spring break. Just like before, there were people both sides of the railings, waiting with their cameras and flowers. Kelly and I sat on the PVC seats near the domestic carousels on the other side of the international gates. I had my arm around her, as if I was cuddling her and chatting away. In fact, I was talking her through some of the finer points of theft. Do you think you can do it? We sat and watched the first wave of domestic arrivals come and collect their luggage. I pinged a potential family. That's the sort of thing we're looking for. But it's two boys. I smiled. You want to be a boy for the day?
No way. Boys smell.
I put my nose into my sweatshirt. I agreed. Okay, we'll wait. A flight arrived from Frankfurt, and this time we struck gold. The parents were late 30s, the kids were about 10 or 11, a girl and a boy. The mother was carrying a clear plastic handbag with white mesh, so you could check everything was where it should be. I couldn't believe our luck. See them? That's what we want. Let's go, shall we? There was a slightly hesitant, yeah. She didn't sound too keen now. All mouth and no trousers, my mother would have said. Should I let her do this? I could cut it right now. As they walked towards the toilets, I had to make a decision. Fuck it. Let's carry on and get this done. She's going in with her daughter, I said. Make sure nobody's behind you. Remember, I'll be waiting. We followed on casually. The husband had left with the boy, perhaps to visit one of the vending machines or to get a taxi or their car. They both went into the toilets via the lady's entrance, chatting and giggling. The woman had the bag over her shoulder. We entered via the men's on the right of the disabled toilets and immediately went into one of the large cubicles. I'll be in this one here, okay, Kelly?
Okay.
Remember what you have to do. I got a big, positive nod. Off you go, then. I closed the door and held it in place. The toilets were large enough for a wheelchair to manoeuvre in. The slightest sound seemed to echo. The floors were wet and smelled of bleach. The timesheet on the back of the door showed that the place had been cleaned only 15 minutes ago. My heart was pumping so hard I could feel it underneath my shirt. My whole future pivoted on the actions of a 7-year-old girl. She had to slip her hand under the cubicle, grab the handbag, put it under her coat, and walk away without looking back. Not difficult, just majorly flawed. But without passports, we couldn't get out of the country. It was as simple as that. There was no way I could go back to Big Al's. Besides the risk of the journey, I couldn't trust him,
for the simple reason that I had no idea what he'd been doing since I left him. It was just too fucking complicated. We needed to get out of this country, and now. I was shaken from my thoughts by a sudden knock-knock-knock, and a nervous, Nick! I opened the door quickly, didn't even look, and in she ran. I closed and locked it, picked her up and carried her over to the toilet. I put down the lid and we sat together. I smiled and whispered, Well done. She looked both excited and scared. I was just scared, because I knew that at any minute, all hell would break loose. And then it came. The mother was running out of the toilet, shouting, I've had my bag stolen. Where's Louise? Louise! The girl came out and started to cry. Mommy! Mommy! I could hear them both run off screaming. Now was not the time to get out. People would be looking, attention would be focused. Let's just sit tight and look at the passports. We'd just robbed Mrs. Fiona Sandborn and family. Fine, except that Mr. Sandborn didn't look at all like Mr. Stone. Never mind. I could do something about that later on. But the names of both kids were entered on each of their parents' passports, and that was a problem. I pulled out the cash and her reading glasses. The toilet cistern was a sealed unit behind the wall. There was nowhere to hide the bag. I got up, told Kelly to stand, and listened at the door. The woman had found a policeman. I imagined the scene outside. A little crowd would have gathered round. The cop would be making notes, radioing control, maybe checking the other cubicles. I broke into a sweat. I stood at the door and waited for what seemed like an hour. Kelly tiptoed exaggeratedly towards me. I bent down, and she whispered in my ear. Is it all right yet? Almost. Then I heard a banging noise and knocking. Somebody was pushing back the doors in the vacant cubicles and knocking on the doors of the others. They were looking for the thief, or, more likely, to see if the bag had been dumped once the money had been taken. They'd be at our cubicle any second. I didn't have time to think. Kelly, you must talk if they knock. I want you to... Knock, knock, knock. In the echo chamber of the disabled toilet, it sounded like the slam of a cell door. A male voice shouted, Hello? Police? Anyone there? He tried to turn the handle. I quickly moved Kelly back to the toilet and whispered in her ear, Say you will be out soon. She shouted, I'm coming out soon. There was no reply. Just the same thing happening at the next cubicle. The danger had passed, or so I hoped. All that was left to do was dump my pistol and mags. That was easy. I slipped them into Fiona's bag and crushed it into a package that would fit in a bin. It was an hour before I decided it was safe to leave. I turned to Kelly. Your name is Louise now, okay? Louise Sandborn.
Okay.
She didn't seem fussed at all. Louise, when we leave here in a minute, I want you to be really happy and hold my hand. With that, I picked up the bag. Okay, we're off.
To England?
Of course. But first of all, we've got to get on the plane. By the way, you were great. Well done. We got into the departures area at 11:30 a.m. Still several hours to go before the first possible flight, the BA216 to Heathrow at 17:10. I went to a phone and, using the numbers in the airport magazine, called each airline in turn to check seat availability. The British Airways flight was fully booked, so was United Airways 918 at 18:10. The BA at 18:10, and the United at 18:40. I eventually managed to find two spare seats on a flight with Virgin at 18:45, and gave all the details of Mr. Sandborn, who was on his way to the airport right now. Payment was courtesy of the details for Big Al's plastic on the car hire form. I wandered past the Virgin desk for a check, and found it didn't open until 1:30 p.m.
1.5 hours to sit and sweat. Terry Sanborn was a little older than me, and his shoulder-length hair was starting to go grey. My hair was just below the ear and brown. Thankfully, his passport was 4 years old. To the delight of Kelly and the terminal's barbershop owner, I underwent a #1 crew cut, coming out looking like a US Marine. We then went into the travel shop, and I bought a pack of painkillers that claimed to be the answer to a woman's period pains. Judging from the list of ingredients, they were certainly the answer for me. All the time, I kept hoping that the police had assumed the motive for the theft was money, and rather than pursuing the matter further, had left it to the Sanborns to report the cards and passport missing. I didn't want to turn up at the ticket sales desk and be jumped on by several hundredweight of cop. Still 30 minutes to go before we could check in. One more thing to do. Kelly, we have to go to the toilet up here for a while.
I don't need to go.
It's for me to get into my disguise. Come and see. We went to the disabled toilet in departures and closed the door. I took out Fiona's glasses. They were gold-framed and had lenses as thick as the bottom of Coke bottles. I tried them on. The frames weren't big enough, but they looked okay. I turned to Kelly and crossed my eyes. Then I had to stop her laughing. I got the painkillers out of the hold-all. I'm going to take this stuff, and it's going to make me ill. But it's for a reason, okay? She wasn't quite sure.
Oh, okay then.
I took 6 capsules and waited. The hot flashes started, then the cold sweats. I put my hands up to show it was okay as 6 donuts and a coffee flew out of my mouth into the toilet bowl. Kelly watched in amazement as I had a rinse in the basin. I looked at myself in the mirror, just as I'd hoped. I looked as pale and clammy as I felt. I took 2 more. There were a few customers at the long line of check-in desks, and only one woman on duty at Virgin Atlantic Sales. She was writing something and her head was down as we approached. She was in her mid-20s, black and beautiful, with relaxed hair pulled back in a bun.
Hello, the name's Sanborn.
Because of the vomiting, my voice was lower and coarse.
There should be 2 tickets for me.
I tried to look disorganized and fucked off.
Hopefully my brother-in-law has booked them.
My eyes looked to the sky in hope.
Sure, do you have a reference number?
Sorry, he didn't give me one, just Sanborn.
She tapped that out and said,
That's fine, Mr. Sanborn. 2 tickets for you and Louise. How many bags are you checking in?
I had the laptop on my shoulder and the hold-all in my hand. I did it, as if working out if I'd need the laptop.
Just this one.
I put the hold-all on the scale. It didn't weigh much, but it was bulked out respectably with the blanket.
Could I see your passport, please?
I looked in all my pockets without apparent success. I didn't want to produce Sanborn's document straight away.
Look, I know we were lucky to get seats at all, but is it possible to make sure we're sitting together?
I leaned in a little closer and half-whispered,
Louise hates flying.
Kelly and I exchanged glances.
That's okay, baby, that's okay.
My voice dropped again.
We're on a bit of a mercy mission.
I looked down at Kelly and back at the woman, my face pained.
Her grandmother's...
I let it hang, as if the rest of the sentence would be too terrible for a little girl's ears.
I'll see what I can do, sir.
She was hitting the keys of her PC at such a speed, it looked as if she was bluffing. I put the passport on top of the counter. She looked up and smiled.
No problem, Mr. Sanborn.
That's marvelous.
But I still wanted to keep the conversation going.
I wondered, would it be possible for us to use one of your lounges? It's just that after my chemotherapy, I tire very easily. We've been rushing around today, and I don't feel too well. I only have to knock myself when I cut.
She looked at my scabs and pale complexion and understood. There was a pause, then she said, "My mother went through chemo for cancer of the liver. The therapy worked. After all that pain, she came through." I thanked her for her concern and message of support. "Now, just get me into the lounge, out of the fucking way." "Let me find out." Smiling at Kelly, she picked up the phone and spoke. After several seconds of weird airline vocabulary, she looked at me and nodded. "That's fine, sir. We share facilities with United. I'll fill out an invitation." I thanked her, and she reached for the passport. I hoped that by now she knew me so well it was just a formality. She flicked it open, and I turned away and talked to Kelly, telling her how exciting it was going to be, flying to see Grandma. I heard, "You'll be boarding at about 5:30. I looked up, all smiles. "Go to Gate C. A shuttle will take you to the lounge. You both have a pleasant flight." "Thank you so much. Come on then, Louise. We've got a plane to catch." I let Kelly walk on a few steps, then turned back to the woman and said, "I just hope Grandma can wait for us." She nodded knowingly. All I wanted to do now was get airside. First hurdle was security. Kelly went through first, and I followed. No alarms. I had to open up the laptop and switch it on to prove it worked, but I'd been expecting that. All the Flavius documents were now in a file entitled Games. We went straight to Gate C, walked through and into the shuttle bus. There was a 5-minute wait while the bus filled up. Then the doors closed. The hydraulics lowered, and we drove about half a mile across the tarmac to the departures lounge proper. The area was plush and busy. I heard a lot of British accents mixed in with snatches of German and French. Kelly and I headed for the United Lounge via a detour to the pick-and-mix stall. We sat quietly with a large cappuccino and a Coke. Unfortunately, the downtime just gave me time to think about whether I'd made any mistakes. A security man walked into the reception and talked to the people on the desk. My heart beat faster. We were so close to the aircraft on the other side of the glass that I felt I could reach out and touch them. I could almost smell the aviation fuel. I told myself to calm down. If they'd wanted us, they would have found us by now. But in truth, so many things could still go wrong that one of them almost certainly would. I was still sweating good style. My head was glistening. And I didn't know if it was the capsules or my flapping, but I was starting to feel weak. "Nick, am I Louise all day today, or just for now?" I pretended to think about it. "The whole day. You're Louise Sandborn all day."
"Why?"
"Because they won't let us go to England unless we use another name." I got a smiling, thoughtful nod. I said, "Do you want to know something else?"
"What's that?"
"If I call you Louise, you have to call me Daddy. But just for today." I wasn't sure what kind of reaction to expect, but she just shrugged.
"Whatever."
Maybe that was what she wanted now. The next 3 hours were grim, but at least we were out of the way. If I'd had any heart problems, I would probably have died. The blood was coursing through me so fast and hard, I could hear it pumping in my ears. I kept saying to myself, "You're here now. There's nothing you can do about it, except it. Just get on that fucking aircraft." I looked at Kelly. "You all right, Louise?"
"Yeah, I'm all right, Daddy."
She had a big smile now. I just hoped she kept it. I watched the receptionist move to the microphone. She announced our flight and told us she had really enjoyed having us stay in the lounge. There were about a dozen others who stood up and started to sort themselves out, folding papers and zipping up bags. I got to my feet and stretched. "Louise?"
"Yep."
"Let's go to England." We walked towards the gate. Father and daughter, hand in hand, talking garbage. My theory went, if I talked with her, they wouldn't talk to us. Four or five people were ahead of us in the queue, like us, families with young children. Passports were being checked by a young Latino. He had an ID card on a chain around his neck, but we were too far away yet for me to make out what it said. Was he airline security or airport security? Two uniformed security men came up and stood behind him, talking to each other. It was the kind of chat that looked so casual it probably wasn't. I used my sleeve to mop sweat from the side of my face. Both the uniformed men were armed. The black guy cracked a joke as the white guy laughed and looked around. Kelly and I shuffled forward. I held her beside me, the protective parent anxious in a crowd. The laptop was over my shoulder. Kelly held a teddy under each arm. We moved three steps forward, another wait. Then it was our turn with the Latino. I wanted to make it all very easy for him. Smiling, I handed him the boarding pass and the passport. I was convinced the uniformed guys were looking at me. I went into boxer mode. Everything was focused on the Latino. Everything else was in the distance, muffled, distorted, peripheral. A bead of sweat fell down my cheek, and I knew he'd noticed it. I knew he could see my chest heaving up and down. Kelly was just behind and to the right of me. I looked at her and smiled. Sir? I silently exhaled in preparation and looked back at him. Just the passport, sir. He handed me back the boarding pass. I grinned, the inexperienced dickhead traveller. He flicked through the pages of the passport, stopping at Sandborn's photograph. He glanced at me, then back at the passport. I'm in the shit. I let him see I was reading his thoughts. Male menopause, I grinned, rubbing my hand over what was left of my hair. My scalp was drenched. The Bruce Willis look. The fucker didn't laugh. He was making up his mind. Eventually he closed the passport and tapped it in his hand. Have a pleasant flight, sir. I went to give him a nod, but he was already paying attention to the people behind me. We moved two paces towards the girls from Virgin and handed them our boarding passes. The two security men didn't budge. We started to walk onto the air bridge, and I felt as if I'd been trying to run through waist-high water and was suddenly on the shoreline. The Latino still worried me. I thought about him all the way onto the aircraft. It was only when I'd found our seats, put the bag and laptop in the overhead locker, settled down and picked up the in-flight magazine, that I took a deep breath and let it out very, very slowly. It wasn't a sigh of relief. I was boosting the oxygen levels in my blood. No, the fucker wasn't happy. His suspicions had been aroused, but he hadn't asked any questions, hadn't even asked my name. We might be on the shoreline, but it was far from being dry land. The aircraft was still filling up. I kept taking deep breaths to try to control my pulse rate. Officials were moving in and out of the aircraft with manifests. Every time it happened, I was expecting to see the two security guys in tow. There was only one entrance, only one exit. There was nowhere to run. As I worked through the scenarios in my mind, I just had to accept the fact that the die was cast. I was a passenger now and, for a fleeting second, I had the same feeling that I'd always had on any aircraft, military or civilian. I was in the hands of others and powerless to decide my own destiny, and I hated it. Still, people were filing on. I nearly burst out in nervous laughter as the speakers played Gloria Gaynor's I Will Survive. I looked at Kelly and winked. She thought it was great, sitting there trying to strap in her teddies. One of the male flight attendants came down our aisle, still wearing his Virgin suit, not yet in shirt-sleeve order. He came down as far as our row of seats and stopped. Judging by his line of sight, he seemed to be checking our seatbelts. It was too early for that, surely. I nodded and smiled. He turned back and disappeared into the galley. I watched the entrance, expecting the worst. One of the female flight attendants poked her head out and looked directly at me. Kelly's teddies were suddenly very interesting. I could feel tingling in my feet. My stomach tightened. I looked up again. She'd gone. The male attendant came out again, carrying a bin liner. He approached us, stopped, and squatted down in the aisle next to Kelly. He said, "Hiya."
"Hello."
He put his hand into the bin liner and I waited for him to bring out the 45. Good ploy, letting me think he's a member of the crew doing something for the kid. He pulled out a little nylon day sack. Splattered all over the back was the Virgin logo and the words, "Kids with Altitude." "We forgot to give you one of these," he said. I nearly hugged him. "Thank you very much." I grinned like an asylum inmate. My eyes 100% larger through the lenses of Fiona's glasses. "Thank you so much." He did his best not to look at me, as if I was indeed some sort of weirdo, then offered us a drink before takeoff. I was gagging for a beer, but I might have to start performing the other side, and anyway, I just wanted to get my head down. We had an orange juice each instead. Sharing the in-flight guide with her, I said, "What film are you going to watch, Louise?"
"Clueless," she grinned.
"Whatever," I said. 20 minutes later, right on schedule, the aircraft finally lifted off from the runway. Suddenly, I didn't mind being in a pilot's hands after all. Chapter 36. We went through all the nonsense of the introduction by the captain. How wonderful it was to have us on board, and when we were going to be fed. My body heat was slowly starting to dry out my sweat-drenched shirt. Even my socks had been wet. I looked over at Kelly. She had a sad face on. I shoved her with my arm. "You okay?"
"I suppose. It's just, I'll miss Melissa. And I didn't even tell her that I'm going to England."
I knew how to get out of this type of thing now.
"Well, all you have to do is think of good things about Melissa, and that will make you feel happy."
I was waiting for her reply. I knew the sort of thing it was going to be.
"What do you think about to make you happy? About your best friend, David?"
Easy. I was prepared.
"Well, nearly 12 years ago, we were working together and he was rebuilding his house and needed a new wooden floor."
She was enjoying this. Stories at bedtime. She certainly looked as if she would go to sleep soon, cuddling up to me. I carried on telling her how we both nicked a squash court floor from one of the HQ Security Forces bases while in Northern Ireland with the debt. We were there at 3 o'clock in the morning with spades, hammers and chisels. We put the boards in a van and brought them over to the mainland. After all, HM government spent all that time and money training us to break in and steal things. Why not use it for ourselves? The next 3 days had been spent laying the hallway and kitchen of the house near Brecon with his nice new flooring. I grinned down at her for a reaction, but she was already sound asleep. I started to watch the video, but knew I was going to fall asleep any minute, so long as the capsules wore off and I could stop my mind going back to the same question over and over again. There was an unholy alliance between Pyra and corrupt elements of the DEA. Of that, there was no doubt. And it very much looked as though Kev's boss was at the center of it. Kev had found out about the corruption, but not who was involved. He wanted to talk to somebody about it. So, was it his boss that he'd unwittingly phoned for an opinion on the day I arrived in Washington? Very unlikely, because Kev would have included him on his list of suspects. Much more probable was that he'd spoken to someone unconnected with the DEA. Someone who would have known what he was talking about and whose opinion he would have valued. Could it have been Luther? He knew Kev. Would Kev have trusted him? Who knows? Whoever he called, he was dead within an hour of putting down the phone. The cabin lights came on a couple of hours before landing, and we were served breakfast. I gave Kelly a nudge, but she groaned and buried herself under the blanket. I didn't bother with the food. From feeling almost elated at having got away with it, I awoke profoundly depressed. My mood was as black as the coffee in front of me. I'd been mad to let myself feel relieved. We weren't out of the woods by a long way. If they knew we were on the aircraft, of course, they wouldn't do anything about it until we landed. It was at the point that I walked off the aircraft and stepped onto the ramp that they'd lift me. Even if that didn't happen, there was immigration. The officials trying to keep out undesirables are much tougher and a lot more on the ball than those in charge of waving you off. They vet your documents that bit more closely, scrutinize your body language, read your eyes. Kelly and I were on a stolen passport. We'd got through at Dulles, but that didn't mean we could pull it off again. I took 4 capsules and finished my coffee. I remembered that I was an American citizen now. When the attendant came past, I asked her for an immigration card. Kelly still wouldn't wake up. Filling in the card, I decided that the Sanborns had just moved and now lived only 1 door away from Mr. and Mrs. Brown. Hunting Bear Path was the only address I could talk about convincingly. If I was lifted at immigration, it wouldn't be the first time. I'd come into Gatwick Airport once from a job. I gave my passport to the immigration officer, and while he was inspecting it, a boy came up on either side, gripped my arms, and took the passport from the official. "Mr. Stanford, Special Branch, come with us." I wasn't going to argue. My cover was good. I was in the UK now. Everything was going to be fine. They strip-searched me in an interview room, firing questions left, right, and center. I went through the whole routine of my cover story. Where I'd been, what I'd been doing, why I'd been doing it. They telephoned my cover and James supported my story. Everything was going swimmingly. Then I got put in the airport detention cells and 3 policemen came in. They wasted no time. They piled in like rugby forwards, 2 holding my arms, 1 throwing punches, then taking turns. They filled me in severely, no word of explanation. Next, I got taken for an interview and was accused of being a paedophile and procuring kids in Thailand. Which was strange, considering I'd been on a deniable op in Russia. There was nothing I could say. It was just down to denying and waiting for the system to get me out. After about 4 hours of interviews, I was sitting in my cell. In came people from the intelligence service to debrief me on my performance. It had been a fucking exercise. They'd been testing all the K's as we came back into the UK. The only trouble was, they'd picked the wrong charge to pull us in on. The police obviously didn't wait for niceties like courtrooms when it came to dealing with child molesters, and everyone who was lifted got taken to one side and given the good news. One bloke, who'd flown into Jersey, got such a severe kicking he ended up in hospital. Kelly was still half asleep, and she looked as rough as I felt. She looked as if she'd been sleeping in a hedge. She yawned and made an attempt to stretch. As she opened her eyes and looked around, completely bewildered, I grinned and offered her the carton of orange juice. "How are you today, Louise?" She still looked lost for a second or two, then got back with the program. "I'm all right." She paused, grinned and added, "Daddy?" She closed her eyes and turned over, trying to sort herself out with a pillow and blanket. I didn't have the heart to tell her we were landing soon. At least I got to drink her orange juice as a Welcome to London video came on the screens. Loads of pomp, circumstance and pageantry. The household cavalry astride their horses. Guardsmen marching up and down. The Queen riding down the Mall in her carriage. To me, London had never looked so good. Then the aircraft landed, and we became actors again. We taxied and stopped at our ramp. Everybody jumped out of their seat as if they were going to miss out on something. I leaned over to Kelly. "Wait here, we're in no rush." I wanted to get into the middle of the crowd. Eventually, we got all the bits and pieces back into Kelly's day sack, organized the teddies and joined the line. I was trying to look ahead, but couldn't see much. We got to the galley area, turned left, and shuffled towards the door. On the ramp were three men. Normal British Airports Authority reception staff in fluorescent jackets who were manning the air bridge, helping a woman into a wheelchair. Things were looking good. Freedom felt so close. We walked up the ramp and joined the spur that led to the main terminal. Kelly didn't have a care in the world, which was good. I didn't want her to understand what was happening. There was heavy foot traffic in both directions, people running with hand luggage, drifting in and out of shops, milling around at gates. I had the day sack and laptop over my shoulder and held Kelly's hand. She carried the teddies. We reached the walkway. Heathrow is the most monitored, most camered, most visually and physically secure airport in the world. Untold pairs of eyes would already be on us. This was no time for looking furtive or guilty. The travelator stopped by gates 43 to 47, then a new one started about 10 meters later. As we trundled along, I waited until there was a gap each side of us and bent down to Kelly. You mustn't forget, I am your daddy today. Okay, Louise Sandborn?
As if, she said with a huge smile.
I just hoped we were both smiling in 30 minutes' time. We came to the end of the walkway and took a down escalator, following signs for passport control and baggage reclaim. From halfway down the escalator, I could see the immigration hall straight ahead. This was where we'd stand or fall. There were about 4 or 5 people waiting to go through each of the desks. I started joking with Kelly, trying to give myself something to do instead of just looking nervous. I'd entered countries illegally hundreds of times, but never so unprepared or under such pressure. All set, Louise?
I'm ready, Daddy.
I passed her the day sack so I could get the passport and visa card out of my pocket. We ambled up to passport control and joined the end of a queue. I kept reminding myself about an American friend who travelled from Boston to Canada, and then from Canada back to the UK. He'd picked up his friend's passport by mistake while they were sharing a hotel room. He couldn't get back to exchange it, so he'd had to bluff it. No one had even batted an eyelid. We waited in line, still with the laptop on my right shoulder. I was holding Kelly's hand with my left. I kept looking down at her and smiling, but not excessively so. That was suspicious behavior, and I knew that people would be watching on monitors and from behind two-way mirrors. The business type in front of us went through with a wave and a smile to the official. It was our turn. We approached the desk. I handed my documents to the woman. She ran her eyes down the details on the card. She looked down at Kelly from her high desk.
Hello. Welcome to England.
Kelly came back with a very American.
Hi.
I guessed the woman was in her late 30s. Her hair was permed, but the perm had gone slightly wrong.
Did you have a nice flight? She asked.
Kelly had Jenny or Ricky in one hand, hanging by her ear, and the other one's head was sticking out from the top flap of her day sack on her back. She said,
Yes, it was fine, thank you.
The woman kept the conversation going.
And what's your name?
She asked, still checking the form. Could I trust her to get it right, or should I butt in? Kelly smiled and said,
Kelly.
What a farce. We'd come so far. We'd come through so much, only to be caught by a line straight from a B-movie. Straight away, I smiled down at Kelly. No, it's not. I didn't want to look at the woman. I could feel the smile drain from her face, could feel her eyes burning into the side of my head. There was a pause that felt like an hour as I tried to think of what to do or say next. I pictured the woman's finger hovering over a concealed button. Kelly got there before me.
I know, I'm joking, she giggled, holding out a teddy. This is Kelly. My name is Louise. What's yours?
My name's Margaret.
The smile was back. If only she'd known how close she'd been to a kill. She opened the passport. Her eyes flicked up and down as she studied first the picture, then my face. She put the passport down below the level of the desk, and I saw the telltale glow of ultraviolet light. Then she looked back into my eyes and said, "When was this picture taken?"
"About 4 years ago, I guess."
I gave a weak smile and said in a low voice that Kelly wasn't meant to overhear,
"I've been having chemotherapy. The hair's just starting to grow back."
I rubbed my head. My skin felt damp and cold. Hopefully I still looked shit. The capsule certainly made me feel it.
"I'm bringing Louise over to see my wife's parents, because it's been quite a traumatic time. My wife's staying with our other child because he's ill at the moment. When it rains, it pours."
"Oh," she said, and it sounded genuinely sympathetic. But she didn't hand back the passport. There was a big lull, as if she was waiting for me to fill the silence with a confession. Or maybe she was just trying to think of something helpful and human to say. Finally, she said, "Have a good stay," and put the documents back on the desktop. There was that urge just to grab them and run.
"Thank you very much," I said,
picking them up and putting them back into my pocket, then carefully doing up the button, because that was what a normal dad would do. Only then did I turn to Kelly.
"Come on, baby, let's go."
I started to walk, but Kelly stood her ground.
"Oh, fuck. Now what?"
"Goodbye, Margaret," she beamed. "Have a nice day."
Then that was it. We were nearly there. I knew there wasn't going to be a problem with the luggage because I wasn't going to collect it. I checked the carousels. There was a flight from Brussels that was also unloading. So I headed for the Blue Channel. Even if they were watching and stopped us because Kelly had a Virgin Airlines bag, I would play the stupid person routine. But there weren't any customs on duty in the Blue Channel. We were free. Chapter 37. The large sliding doors opened up into the arrivals hall. We walked through into a throng of chauffeurs holding up cards and people waiting for their loved ones. Nobody gave us a second look. I went straight to the Bureau de Change. I found I'd done well last night with Ron, Melvin and the Sandborns, ending up with over £300 in cash. Like a nugget, I forgot to ask for a small denomination note for the machine, and we had to queue for ages for tube tickets. It didn't seem to matter. Even the hour-long ride to Bank Station was enjoyable. I was a free man. I was amongst ordinary people. None of them knew who we were, or was going to pull a gun on us. The city is a strange mixture of architecture. As we left the station, we passed grand buildings comprised of columns and puritanically straight lines. The old establishment. Turn a corner, and we were confronted by monstrosities that were built in the 60s and early 70s by architects who must have taken a let's-go-fuck-up-the-city pill. One of these buildings was the one I was heading for. The NatWest Bank in Lombard Street. A road so narrow that just one car could squeeze down it. We went through the revolving steel and glass doors into the banking hall, where rows of cashiers sat behind protective screens. But I wasn't there for money. The reception desk was manned by a man and a woman, both in their early 20s, both wearing NatWest suits. They even had little corporate motifs sewn into the material of the breast pocket, probably so the staff wouldn't wear them out of hours. As Kelly would have said,
"As if."
I saw both of them give Kelly and me an instant appraisal, and could feel them turning up their noses. I gave them a cheery, "Hi, how are you?" and asked to speak with Guy Bexley. The woman said,
"Can I have your name, please?"
as she picked up the phone. "Nick Stevenson." The girl called an extension. The man went back to being efficient on the other side of the reception desk. I bent down and whispered to Kelly,
"I'll explain later."
"He'll be along in a minute. Would you like to sit down?"
We waited on a settee that was very long, very deep, and very plastic. I could sense Kelly's cogs turning. Sure enough. Nick, am I Louise Stevenson now, or Louise Sanborn? I screwed up my face and scratched my head. Kelly. Guy Bexley came down. Guy was my relationship manager, whatever that was. All I knew was that he was the man I asked for when I wanted to get my security blanket out. He was late 20s, and you could see by his hairstyle and goatee beard that he felt uncomfortable in the issued suit, and would be far happier wearing PVC trousers, holding a bottle of water and raving all night bare-chested. We shook hands. Hello, Mr. Stevenson. Haven't seen you for a long time. I shrugged my shoulders. Work. This is Kelly. He bent down and said, Hello there, Kelly. In his best, I've been trained how to introduce myself to kids manner. I just need my locked box for 5 minutes, mate. I followed him towards the row of partitioned offices on the other side of the hall. I'd been in them many times before. They were all identical. Each contained just a round table, 4 chairs and a telephone. It was where people went to count money or beg for a loan. He started to leave. Could I also have a statement on my diamond reserve, please? Guy nodded and left. Kelly said, What are we doing here? I should have known by now that she hated to be left out of things, just like her dad. Wait and see, I winked. A few minutes later, Guy reappeared, put the box on the table, and gave me a folded printout of my account. I felt nervous as I opened up the paper. My eyes went straight for the bottom right-hand corner. 426,570 dollars, converted at a rate of $1.58 to the pound. Big Al had done it. I had to control myself as I remembered Bexley was still standing there. I'll just be about 5 minutes, I said. Tell reception when you're ready. They'll put it back in the vault for you. He left with a shake of my hand and a, Bye, Kelly, and closed the door behind him. The box was 18 inches by 12 inches, a metal file container I'd bought for a tenner in Woolworths, with a very cheap lock on the top that opened under pressure. I'd been planning to rent a proper safe deposit box, but then I'd remembered about the Knightsbridge raid years before. Also, it meant I'd have to turn up with a key, and I couldn't guarantee I was going to have that with me. This way was easier. The only problem was that, if I had to do a runner out of the country, it could only be during banking hours. I flipped the lock and pulled out a couple of old private eyes I'd put on top in case it accidentally opened. I threw them over to Kelly. See if you can make any sense of those. She picked one up and started to flick through the pages. The first thing I took out was the mobile phone and recharger. I switched it on. The battery was still working, but I put it in the recharger anyway and plugged it into the wall. Next, I pulled out a clear plastic carrier bag which contained bundles of US dollar bills and pounds sterling. 5 South African Krugerrands and 10 half-sovereigns that I'd stolen after the Gulf War. All troops who were behind enemy lines in Iraq were issued with 20 of the things as bribes for the locals in case we were in the shit. In my patrol, we'd managed to keep 10 of them each. We said we'd lost the rest in a contact. To begin with, I'd only kept them as souvenirs, but they'd soon increased in value. I left them in the bag. I was only interested in the sterling. I dug out a European leather portemonnaie with a strap in which I had a complete set of ID. Passport, credit cards, driver's license, all the stuff I needed to become Nicholas Duncan Stevenson. It had taken years to get cover in such depth, all originating from a social security number I'd bought in a pub in Brixton for 50 quid. I then got out an electronic notebook. It was great. It meant that anywhere in the world, I could fax, send memos, do word processing, and maintain a database. The problem was I didn't have a clue how to use it. I just used the phone number and address facility because it could only be accessed with a password. I had a quick look over at Kelly. She was thumbing through the eye, not understanding a word. I pushed my hand to the bottom of the box and extracted the 9mm semi-automatic Browning that I'd liberated from Africa in the late 80s. Loading the mags with rounds from a small Tupperware box, I made ready and checked chamber. Kelly looked up, but didn't give it a second glance. I powered up the notebook, tapped in 2422 and found the number I wanted. I picked up the telephone on the table. Kelly looked up again.
Who are you phoning?
Ewan.
Who is he?
I could see the confusion on her face. He's my best friend. I carried on pressing the phone number.
But...
I put my finger to my lips.
Shh.
He wasn't in. I left a message on the answering machine in veiled speech. Then I put the laptop into the box, together with everything that I wasn't taking with me, including the printout. Kelly was bored with the eyes now, so I took them off her to put back in the box. I knew there was a question on its way.
Nick?
I just carried on packing. Yes?
You said David was your best friend.
Ah, yes. Well, Ewan is my best friend. It's just that sometimes I have to call him David because... I started to think of a lie. But why? I told you because if we got caught, then you wouldn't know his real name. That way you couldn't tell anyone. It's something that is done all the time. It's called OPSEC, Operational Security. I finished packing and closed the box. She had thought about it.
Oh, okay. His name's Ewan, then.
When you see him, he might even show you the floor we talked about. I poked my head round the corner and waved at the receptionist. She came in, picked up the box and left. I turned to Kelly. Right then, time for a shopping frenzy. Let me see. We'd better buy some nice new clothes for us both. And then we'll go and stay in a hotel and wait for Ewan to ring. Sound good to you? Her face brightened.
Okay.
Once this was all over, I would have to set up a different named account and move the money, and I'd stop being Stevenson. A pain in the ass to organize, but I could live with that for $426,570. The cab ride to Trafalgar Square became a tour given by me to Kelly. I was more into it than she was, and I could tell by the taxi driver's expression in his rearview mirror that I was getting most of the details wrong. We were going down the Strand when I spotted clothes shops on both sides of the road. We paid off the taxi and shopped for jeans, T-shirts and washing kit. Once done, we got another cab and I asked for Brown's Hotel. I said to Kelly, "You'll like this place. It's got two entrances. So you can enter from Dover Street and come out the other side, on Albemarle Street. Very important for spies like us." I switched on the phone, got hold of directory inquiries, and called the hotel to make a reservation. Less than half an hour later, we were in our room. But only after showing off to Kelly and discovering that the Dover Street exit was no longer open. Finger on the pulse. The room was a world removed from the ones we had been used to. It was plush, comfortable, and, best of all, it had a minibar with Toblerones. I could have killed a beer, but not yet. There was work to do. Jet lag was starting to kick in. Kelly looked exhausted. She flopped onto the bed and I undressed her and threw her between the sheets. "You can have a bath tomorrow," I said. She was a starfish in about 2 minutes flat. I checked that the phone had a good signal and that the charger was working. Ewan knew my voice and my message. "It's John the plumber. When do you want me to come and fix that tap?" "Give me a ring on." Would have done the trick. I decided to have a quick nap for 10 minutes, maybe shower, have something to eat, then go to bed. After all, it was only 5 p.m. 10 minutes later, at 5:45 in the morning, the phone rang. I pressed receive. I heard,
"Hello?"
in that very low, very controlled voice I knew so well. "I need a hand, mate," I said. "I need you to help me. Can you get to London?"
When do you want me?
Now.
I'm in Wales. It'll take a bit of time.
I'll wait out on this number.
No problem. I'll get a train. It'll be quicker.
Thanks, mate. Give me a call about an hour before you get into Paddington.
Yep, okay.
The phone went dead. I had never felt so relieved. It was like putting down the phone after a doctor's just told you the cancer test was negative. The train journey alone would take over 3 hours, so there wasn't much to do apart from enjoy the lull in the battle. Kelly woke up as I caught up with the election battle in the copy of the Times that had been slipped under the door. And I walked to the street corner with some change at Brown's. I phoned room service and tried out the TV channels. No Power Rangers. Great. In lazy time, we both eventually got up, showered, changed, and were looking good. We took a leisurely stroll to the station through Piccadilly Circus, Leicester Square and Trafalgar Square. I delivered another tour lecture that Kelly didn't listen to. All she wanted to do was feed the pigeons. I kept on looking at my watch, waiting for Ewan to call. And while Kelly was still being overrun by pigeons having a feeding frenzy in the square, the phone rang. It was 9:50 a.m. I put my finger in my other ear to block out the traffic and the screams of delight from Kelly, and the other kids as birds trying to peck their eyes out.
I'm an hour from Paddington.
That's great. I'll meet you at Platform 3, Charing Cross Station, okay, mate?
See you there.
The Charing Cross Hotel was part of the station complex and just 2 minutes' walk from Trafalgar Square. I'd picked it because I knew that, from the foyer, you could see the taxis pull into the station and drop off their fares. We waited and watched. The place was full of package tour Americans and Italians. The Americans were at the tour guide desk, booking every show in town. And the Italians just moved from the lift to the exit door in one loud, arm-waving mob, shouting at each other and all trying to get through the glass doors at the same time. It was about half an hour later that I saw a cab with a familiar figure in the back. I pointed him out to Kelly.
Aren't we going to go and meet him?
No, we're going to stay here and look, because we're going to surprise him. Just like we did in Daytona, remember?
Oh, yes, we have to stand off.
I watched him get out. It was so wonderful to see him that I wanted to jump up and run outside. He was dressed in jeans and wearing the kind of shoes you see advertised in a Sunday supplement. Hush puppies were positively cutting-edge fashion compared to these. He was also wearing a black nylon bomber jacket, so he'd be easy enough to pick out in a station. I said to Kelly, "We'll give him a couple of minutes, then we'll go and surprise him, shall we?"
"Yeah."
She sounded quite excited. She had two lumps of bird shit on the back of her coat. I was waiting for them to dry before picking them off. I stood off for 5 minutes, watching his arse for him. Then we walked towards the station and through a couple of arches to the ticket offices. The station was renovated Victorian, with W.H. Smith and all the other normal outlets. We looked for Platform 3, and there he was, leaning against the wall reading a paper. The same feeling. I wanted to run over there and hug him. We walked slowly. He looked up and saw me. We both smiled and said, "Hi, how's it going?" He looked at me, then at Kelly. But he didn't say anything. He knew that I'd tell him at some stage. We went off to the side of the station to steps that led us down towards the river. As we walked, he looked at my head and tried to hide a grin.
"Good haircut."
Outside Embankment Station, we got into a taxi. Drills are drills. They're there for a reason, and that is to protect you. The moment you start falling down on drills, you start fucking up. We took the driver a roundabout route, covering our asses, taking 20 minutes to Brown's instead of the straight line 10. As soon as we got back to the room, I turned on the TV for Kelly and phoned room service. Everyone was hungry. Ewan was already chatting away with Kelly. She looked pleased to have somebody else to talk to, even if it was only another grown-up and a man. That was good. They were getting a relationship going. She was feeling comfortable with him.
The food came. There was a beef burger and chips for Kelly, and two club sandwiches for us. I said to Kelly, "We'll let you eat in peace. We're going into the bathroom because you're watching TV, and I want to talk to Ewan about some stuff. Is that all right?" She nodded, mouth already full. Ewan smiled. "See you in a minute, Kelly. Save us a chip." We went into the bathroom with our coffees and sandwiches, the noise of the TV dying the moment I closed the door. I started to tell him the story. Ewan listened intently. He was visibly upset about Kev and Marcia. I'd got as far as the lift by Luther and Co. when he cut in. By now he was sitting on the edge of the bath.
"Bastards! Who were they? Do you think it was the same group that zapped Kev?"
"Must be." I sat next to him. Kev knew the three who killed him. Kelly confirmed that Luther worked with Kev. Then there's the question of that phone call to get the ball rolling.
"You reckon it was Luther?"
I nodded. "Fuck knows where he fits into the picture, but my guess is he's DEA, and also corrupt. It looks like some of the DEA are bent and working for drug money." I told him about the McGeer killing and what I had found on the backup disc once DeSabatino had opened the gifts. Ewan understood so far.
"So, it all has to do with Pyra running drugs into Europe. To keep the route open, it needs backhanders, blackmail and threats. But what about McGeer? Did he say anything?"
"Not a word. He knew he was going to die anyway."
"This guy, DeSabatino, does he have any copies of the Int?"
I laughed. "You know I'm not going to tell you that. OPSEC, mate. OPSEC."
"Fair one," he shrugged. "Just being nosy."
I carried on and explained what I had found in Kev's house. Ewan didn't speak. He just sat there, letting it all soak in. I felt suddenly exhausted, as if by somehow passing on the baton to Ewan, everything that had happened in the last 10 days could at last catch up with me and take its toll. I looked at him. He looked pretty drained himself.
"I can only see one thing wrong with what you're saying."
"What's that, mate?"
"Wouldn't the Colombians have anticipated that a bomb would heighten security on the rock, making it harder to get the drugs in?"
"It was a warning. They were sending out our gypsies to anyone else who might not want to keep business going. I tell you, mate, this is far too big for me to be messing around with. I just want to get it to Simmons and wash my hands of it."
"I'll help any way I can."
He opened a packet of Benson and Hedges. He'd obviously taken up the weed again. I stood up, out of the way. "I don't want to get you directly involved. Kev, Pat, me, we've all been fucked over. But I'm going to need you to back me if things go wrong."
"You just have to name it."
I could smell the sulphur from his match. He smiled as I started to wave the smoke from my face. He knew that I hated it. Even under extreme pressure, some things never changed. I said, "Tomorrow afternoon, you should receive copies of the files by FedEx. If anything happens to me or Simmons, it's basically down to you." By now, we were in a cloud of smoke. Any minute now, the alarm was going to go off.
"No problems with that, mate,"
he said in his very slow, very calm, very calculating way. If you told Ewan he'd won the national lottery, he'd say, "That's nice," then go back to stacking his coins or folding his socks.
"How many copies of the disc are there, besides the ones you're sending me?"
"I'm not going to tell you, mate. Need to know." He smiled. He knew I was protecting him. "One more thing," I said. "I don't want to take Kelly with me to the Simmons meet. He wasn't too pleased with me the last time we spoke. If this turns into a gang fuck, I don't want her caught in the crossfire. You're the only person I can trust her with. It's only going to be for one night, maybe two. Can you do that for me?" I expected an immediate answer, and I got one.
"No problem."
A smile crossed his face. He knew I'd let him talk freely with Kelly so they'd get to know each other. "Will you take her back to..."